The cost of gold and green, the cost of gold and green. Since opening our cafe in Priory Park, we quickly sensed a chill beneath the surface charm of Raygate. On social media, a wave of simmering resentment rolled in. It seemed we had unknowingly trespassed on sacred ground. Our predecessors, as we soon discovered, had cultivated a fiercely loyal following. The backlash was sharp, sometimes petty, often personal. Every time one of our regulars posted a kind word about us, someone on the I Love Raygate Facebook page would swoop in with a stinging rebuttal. Some went as far as attacking individual team members. Even Paul, the local military fitness guru, took aim, declaring on social media that his Earl Grey was horrible. We were baffled. We'd been serving Birchall tea, a brand rooted in family tradition since 1872. It was high quality, so how could this be? The negativity was draining. It became harder and harder not to take it personally. To keep morale afloat, I told the team what I believed. This is the price of success. You're being noticed. At the same time, change was brewing elsewhere. Our Banstead franchise agreement expired in 2014. Neil and Ertha, the operators there, decided not to renew. We respected their choice and negotiated a £20,000 buyout for their exit. We resumed direct control of the cafe and immediately listed it on businessesforsale.com, looking for a new owner. Then, out of the blue, the most bizarre chapter unfolded. While on holiday in Marmaris, Turkey, Adrian, my business partner, and his longtime girlfriend Cindy had an awkward chance encounter. In the sun-drenched bustle of the Turkish coast, Adrian locked eyes with a familiar face, Marius, a boisterous Polish man with a broad grin. Years ago, Marius had worked for Adrian on the Camden contract under Glendale. Their last meeting had been anything but cordial. Adrian had fired him. A hard goodbye, sharp words, and no love lost. Yet fate, with its twisted sense of humor, decided to script a reunion. When they crossed paths in Marmaris, there was no hostility, no grudges simmering under the sun. Instead, Marius greeted Adrian with a bear hug and a grin as wide as the Aegean. Over clinking glasses and the salty breeze, he confessed something unexpected. Getting sacked had been the best thing that ever happened to him. That sting of rejection, it had ignited something fierce. With nothing left to lose, he built his own empire from scratch, a construction company cheekily named Like Magic. He handpicked a crew of skilled Polish craftsmen, undercut the competition, and within months, his name was everywhere. Jobs rolled in. Money followed. Mariusz wasn't just surviving, he was thriving. And, to Adrian's surprise, grateful. The holiday turned into a celebration of second chances. Their families bonded over long, lazy meals, waves whispering against the shore as laughter replaced old bitterness. When Adrian flew home, he didn't just bring back a tan, he brought back Marius. Diane and I met him soon after. By coincidence, we were wrestling with a domestic headache. The kitchen floor had started to sag ominously, like it was hiding a secret. Subsidence, we feared. A homeowner's nightmare. Marius arrived, crouched low like a detective at a crime scene, and within minutes solved the mystery. Not shifting foundations, but something far sneakier. A washing machine hose that had been weeping silently for years, rotting the joists beneath our feet. His verdict was blunt, his solution swift. Within days, his team tore through the mess, replaced the joists, and set everything right. Fair price, flawless work. What began as a rescue mission turned into a friendship. But Marius wasn't finished with surprises. Back in Marmaris, while they were all drinking beer by the beach, he casually dropped a bombshell. During his holiday, he'd bid on a 2-bedroom flat on eBay. Yes, eBay. He'd lost, but then fate winked again, the winner backed out, and now the property was his for the taking, if he wanted it. First, though, he wanted to see it in person. And then came surprise number 2, delivered with a mischievous glint in his eye. Before I came to England, he said, I ran a jet ski business on the Black Sea. Made a fortune. He looked out at the turquoise expanse of Marmaris Bay and shrugged, like the answer was obvious. They don't have jet skis here. Locals say they can help me get the permits. Big opportunity. Adrian was hooked immediately, his mind spinning with possibilities. Me? I was less convinced. Running a jet ski business in Turkey while living in the UK sounded like a logistical circus. Still, I agreed to join the talks, if only out of curiosity. The flat became our excuse. So in November, the three of us boarded a flight back to Marmaris, Adrian, Marius, and me. That's when Marius reminded us why he was a wild card. From his bag, he produced 2 bottles of vodka, smuggled through security like contraband treasure. By the time we touched down, he and Adrian had drained most of it. They stumbled off the plane, laughing loud and utterly plastered. Not ideal, considering we had a meeting with Turkish officials that very evening. By 8 p.m., they were dressed, if you could call it that, shirts creased, collars askew, but faces wearing that stubborn determination only vodka can give. They wobbled into the hotel lobby beside me, trying their best to pass for respectable businessmen. Waiting for us were our hosts, sharp suits, polished shoes, the kind of men who carried themselves like the gatekeepers of opportunity. We were escorted to a sleek bar, its marble gleaming under low amber lights, and introduced to 2 men, government officials, or so we were told. The tableau that followed was pure theater, a towering Polish builder with fractured English, a Jamaican entrepreneur with a voice like silk, and me, the rotund Turkish guy pretending not to understand a word of Turkish. I listened as the officials leaned close, speaking in low, skeptical tones. They were sizing us up, testing our story, murmuring under their breath, "Are these guys for real?" And that's when I broke. A laugh burst out of me, loud, unexpected, shattering the tension. "Gentlemen," I said in perfect Turkish, "allow me to introduce myself properly." Their faces froze, then cracked into smiles as the charade dissolved. The room shifted, drinks flowed, shoulders relaxed. Adrian and Marius sobered up, like magic. We dined together, shared stories, and left the evening with an understanding. The jet ski dream was possible, but only if we secured beach rights from a local hotel. The next morning we traded cocktails for car keys, setting out to view the flat that had sparked this whole detour. 4 grueling hours later, plus 1 shredded tire and a roadside wait under a merciless sun, we arrived. What we found was less a home and more a postcard from the apocalypse. A spotless, airy apartment perched in the middle of nowhere, a ghost town with sea views. It was a hard no. Marius's wife would never live there alone with the kids. Back in Marmaris, things didn't exactly improve. We missed the official's boat party, the one that might have sealed a deal. Instead, Marius dragged us through the chaos of the bazaar. He had an obsession with gold and jewelry. Adrian and I had an obsession with bad decisions. Somewhere between rounds of Rocky, slices of pizza, and the relentless charm of Turkish shopkeepers, we did the unthinkable. Adrian bought a Rolex for £1,000. We also picked up a diamond ring for Cindy, both on the company card. We told ourselves it was an investment. Truthfully, it was sunshine, ego, and alcohol making a cocktail of delusion. On our final day, nursing sore heads and thinner wallets, we wandered down to the marina. That's when we saw her, the gullet, a masterpiece of Turkish craftsmanship, resting on water like a swan in polished mahogany and glinting brass. We couldn't help it. We loitered like kids with noses pressed against a sweet shop window. The captain spotted us from the deck, a weathered man with eyes like deep water and a grin sharp enough to cut rope. "Come, have a look," he called in his musical, accented English, waving us aboard like honored guests instead of 3 curious idiots with no plan. Climbing that gangway felt like stepping into another world. This wasn't just a boat, it was a floating palace. Varnished wood gleamed in the winter sun, sails furled with military precision, every brass fitting polished to a jealous shine. Below deck, it smelled of salt, teak oil, and money. The captain gave us the grand tour, his words tumbling out like an invitation to temptation. Private charters, bespoke cruises along the Aegean, summers booked solid with wealthy Europeans. A lucrative business, he said, if you knew the right people. And there we stood, 3 men nursing wild dreams and mild hangovers, staring at that gleaming gullet and wondering, what if? When we told him we were visiting from the UK on business, exploring potential tourism opportunities in Marmaris, his eyes lit up. "Maybe we do something together," he said, his voice suddenly full of possibility. "Let me show you around." He led us below deck where the air turned cool and fragrant with polished wood. Room after room unfolded, sumptuous cabins, sleek bathrooms, an opulent saloon that felt more like a boutique hotel lobby than the belly of a boat. Then, as if it were all part of the pitch, he offered lunch. Not a sandwich or a snack, but a full spread prepared by the ship's private chef. Plates of grilled fish, fresh salads, warm bread, and delicate pastries appeared as if summoned by magic. We sat at a teak table on the upper deck, the sea glittering below us, the scent of salt and lemon in the air, clinking glasses with a man we'd met only 20 minutes earlier. Business cards and numbers were exchanged with the ease of seasoned dealmakers, the kind of exchange that hinted at future ventures, or at least the fantasy of them. And for a moment, as the boat rocked gently beneath us and laughter rose into the clear blue sky, it felt like anything was possible. Another maybe venture planted in our ever-growing garden of possibilities. But when we returned to the UK, reality hit hard. The Rolex, fake. The diamond ring we joked Adrian should buy for Cindy, also fake. And our brief flirtation with international entrepreneurship was now tinged with foolishness. Yet somehow, greed still had its grip. Back in the UK, with the sting of Marmaris still raw and the fake Rolex buried deep in a drawer of quiet shame, Marius came barreling in with yet another big idea, this time wrapped in pine-scented promise. Christmas trees, he grinned, eyes glittering with the same reckless enthusiasm that had once convinced us to buy a diamond ring that sparkled like glass. From Poland, top quality, dirt cheap, we'll clean up. Adrian was hooked instantly. Me? I wasn't buying it. This isn't what we do, I said, shaking my head. We run cafes, not bloody forests. But Marius was relentless, and as I sat there listening, a memory crept in, one that weakened my resolve. One Christmas, years earlier, Remy had set up a tree stall outside our cafe at Manor House Gardens. I'd been skeptical then too, but he sold out, every last tree gone in a flash. He'd made good money, and I'd admired his hustle. That memory lingered like a whisper. Why not? And the truth was, I liked to gamble on myself. I'd always had that streak, the risk-taker's itch. One more roll of the dice. All right, I said finally, half smiling. Let's do it. From that moment, the train had left the station. Adrian flew with Marius to Poland to seal the deal. They walked through snow-dusted yards stacked with perfect, fragrant evergreens, straight out of a Christmas card. The growers were friendly, the price unbeatable. By the time Adrian landed back at Heathrow, he was all in, his suitcase practically humming with tinsel and optimism. Together, Pistachios in the Park placed an order for 2,000 trees, a forest's worth of festive hope. Marius even struck a deal with a big North London retailer to take 500 off our hands straight away. On paper, it looked like a seasonal gold mine, but fate, oh fate, had other plans. Just as we geared up for our Yuletide coup, the world changed overnight. A terrorist attack rocked Paris, borders across Europe snapped shut, lorries stalled in endless queues. Our trees were trapped somewhere between Poland and Dover. Then came the call we dreaded. The London retailer, spooked by delays and running out of time, pulled out. Suddenly, we weren't looking at a neat split and easy sales. We were staring down the barrel of 2,000 Christmas trees, most of which hadn't even arrived. When the first lorry finally rolled in, relief gave way to fresh panic. The trees were all the same size, 6 to 8 feet, and worse, not a single base. We weren't selling Christmas trees. We were flogging giant green javelins that toppled if you sneezed. To make matters worse, storage was already bleeding us dry. Marius had arranged to keep them at a gospel church on an East London retail park. Noble, right? Wrong. It came with an upfront fee, ours to pay, of course, along with the hire of 2 hulking transit vans to ferry the stock. Sales were a disaster. Rain-lashed markets, muddy boots, customers walking past with tight smiles, no shelter, no magic, just us and a mountain of unsold fur. Then a flicker of hope. Tom Matthews, our old showman friend from Salford, stepped in like a Christmas miracle. He had yard space, plenty of it, and he offered to store what was left for free. But the damage was done. By Christmas Eve, Adrian and I were still out there, freezing, hauling trees across London like disgraced carol singers. The festive cheer was gone. All that remained was sap, sweat, and despair. In the bitter end, we dumped the stragglers at the Glendale Depot, where they met their undignified fate, shredded into mulch. What was supposed to be a sleigh ride to seasonal success had turned into a slow-motion train wreck. A venture born in glitter ended in silence and sawdust. Never again. Just when we thought we'd survived the chaos of fake Rolexes, shredded Christmas trees, and cursed beach ventures in Marmaris, fate dealt us another devastating blow, this time in full, merciless view of the public. It started quietly, a tweet, a photo, a single ping in our inbox. And then it ignited. Ortis Deli, the affable and respected host of The Gadget Show, a man whose voice was trusted in millions of homes, had posted a tweet that hit like a freight train. So Pistachio's ITP Rigate thought it was okay to serve my wife this to give to my 18-month-old. #WTAF disgusted. Attached was a photo that instantly turned our stomachs and very nearly turned our business inside out. There, laid out like a parody of a wholesome toddler lunch, was a small tray containing a few slices of cucumber, some carrot sticks, a pot of hummus, and most disturbingly, chunks of pita bread riddled with green mold. But what struck us immediately, beyond the mold, was the container. It was a cheap yellow polystyrene box, the kind typically found in late-night kebab shops or motorway truck stops. We don't use those, ever. At Pistachios in the Park, we've built our brand on sustainability, family, and quality. We've always used Vegware, plant-based compostable packaging that reflects our values and commitment to the environment. And yet here it was, a yellow styrofoam tray, glaringly out of place like a crime scene clue. As if that wasn't enough, the hummus had been served in what looked like a cut-down disposable coffee cup, a practice we explicitly banned for hygiene and presentation reasons. It didn't make sense. It wasn't just moldy food, it was something foreign, something that simply didn't belong in our cafe. But the internet didn't care about inconsistencies. The post went viral within minutes. Angry parents and online watchdogs circled like sharks. Food bloggers dissected every pixel of the photo. Mumsnet declared war. Headlines screamed. TV star's baby served moldy lunch at Surrey Cafe. Our hearts sank. This wasn't just a complaint. It was a public lynching. The name Pistachios in the Park was being dragged through digital mud. We rushed out a response. Cautious, maybe too cautious. Hiya, daily inspections do take place. I would like to question, was it from our cafe? If so, who would cut serve it up without noticing? It was meant to open a dialogue. Instead, it landed like a slap in the face. Ortis didn't hesitate. Are you suggesting the serving was faked by my wife? Now, we weren't just being accused of feeding mold to a toddler. We were being painted as gaslighters. And we had no time to clarify before the mob made up its mind. Desperate to uncover the truth, we scoured our records. Food logs, clean, hygiene checks, up to date. Then came the breakthrough. The tray had been prepared by a new staff member, someone who'd only been with us for a single shift. One day, one moment of negligence, a mistake that spiraled into national headlines. We let them go the same day. Gabriella Adolfi, one of our senior partners, issued a public statement. Pistachios in the Park, Priory Park, Raygate are aware of a food hygiene incident that began circulating on social media today. We are reviewing the circumstances surrounding the post. We have spoken to the employee responsible who joined our team on Friday and have terminated his position with immediate effect. It was the truth. But one thing still gnawed at us. Even if the food had been mishandled by a rogue employee, why was it served in packaging we've never used? Why a polystyrene box? Why the makeshift hummus cup? It didn't fit, and try as we might, we could never fully explain it. Had the food been repackaged? Was the staff member using materials they'd brought in themselves? Had a well-intentioned attempt at takeaway turned into a PR catastrophe? We may never know, but the damage was done. Parents recoiled. Some regulars vanished. The whispers started. If that's what they served to a TV presenter's kid, what about the rest of us? And what hurt most wasn't just the financial fallout. It was the sheer sense of betrayal, of failing our core mission to be a safe, welcoming space for families. We had survived dodgy business deals, ruthless online trolls, and jet ski daydreams in foreign lands. But this was different. Because we didn't just lose money. We lost trust. And rebuilding that would take far more than compostable packaging and PR statements.